Hello, everyone, and welcome to the inaugural broadcast, or should I say podcast, of National Bugle Radio. And I am your host, Patrick Slattery, and today I have my inaugural guest, Pastor Mark Dankoff, who is a very widely sought-after commentator on international matters, national matters, theological matters. And today he's here, and we are going to be talking about the Brexit vote and its implications for Europe, for the New World Order, for America, and who knows what else. So, welcome to the show, Mark.
It's always good to see you, Patrick. We've worked together in two or three different venues, and of course, this is the latest one, and that's just terrific that we're doing what we're doing tonight. Just spend an hour or more, whatever you need, just putting some ideas together on some of the leading issues of the day and of the last week.
Okay, good. So, regarding this Brexit vote, what do you see as being the big implications?
Well, I think there are a number of big implications in this. The question is, how big? We simply, at this point, do not know. Clearly, when you're looking across the American and European political spectrum, it's quite obvious that this thing has had a shockwave effect throughout the Western world and throughout the world generally. Barack Obama, on the one hand, was saying basically that all of this hysteria in the wake of the Brexit vote was not warranted. He was trying to play down the implications of the vote. He was trying to play down the significance of it. He was insisting that this did not mean that the global order was going to come down or that we were going to get out of NATO or any of those kinds of things. I know I was asked to comment on this for 3 minutes today on press television, Iran, after I got off of the David Duke show on Rents Radio this morning. And I told press television that the president might well be right, that maybe this is going to be just a slight glitch or a slight bump in the road that's going to result in the kinds of adjustments being made by the political establishment, the global political establishment, necessary to dampen down its impact, the Brexit vote impact, and to dampen people's fervor over many of the issues that caused this vote to be taken in Britain, and where similar movements are well underway throughout Europe. And obviously in this country right now, we've got a national election where some of these feelings and some of these issues are making their way to the fore in this whole business of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, looking at this thing from the vantage point of Pat Buchanan, he is clearly convinced, or seems to be. I've read the last couple of major articles that Pat's put out on this. I think Buchanan feels very much that this could be a portent of a Trump victory fall. Buchanan clearly has in mind the idea that at least some of us hope for, which is that this could well be not simply a prelude to the defeat of Hillary Clinton, but that maybe some of these other globalist dominoes will start falling also, both in terms of some of the worst aspects of this among our leading globalist politicians in the United States, and for that matter in Europe. But I think Buchanan is thinking, gee, this is what we've been hoping for so long. This could be the beginning of getting out of NAFTA, getting out of GATT, getting out of the World Trade Organization, getting out of the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, dumping the IMF and the mm-hmm. World Bank and all the rest of it, and International Monetary Fund and so forth and so on. And gee, wouldn't it be great if we could get out of NATO? This would be terrific. Wow. Well, I agree with that, and that's basically what my article advocates. Should be extended result of all of this in a best-case scenario. But on the other hand, this is the first victory that we have had, those of us of our political persuasion, in a long time that's been getting much notice at all internationally, and it's just a beginning. If it fizzles out, if it's not followed both in Britain as well as in the rest of Europe, as well as in the United States, by a really real substantive, ongoing, properly understood rebellion, political change, then we've got big-time problems, and I think that those problems will simply be exacerbated to the point of explosion if Hillary Clinton is elected.
Okay, so yeah, a lot of this would hinge on a Donald Trump election, it would seem, especially in the near to midterm. And I'd like to talk about the Donald Trump campaign, but a little bit later. You had mentioned NATO, you know, this as a bill, as foreshadowing a possible disintegration of NATO. Well, so we're talking about the EU first. What Britain voted to exit was the EU. Britain joined the EU's predecessor, the European Common Market, back in, I believe, 1974 was when its membership went into effect. It wasn't a founding member. The original members of the common market were France, Italy, Germany. France and Italy, really. I mean, Germany and Italy really being the core members. Germany and France being the core members, but Italy and then the three small Benelux countries, and it grew out from there. But England was in the first round of new additions. So, of course, NATO goes back much further than that. It goes back to the late 40s. And so the idea of a disintegration of EU leading to a disintegration of NATO is a very interesting one. And, of course, Donald Trump has talked about NATO. Why are we still in NATO? Has it outlived its usefulness? But the membership in NATO and the membership in the EU overlap to a very large extent. Not exactly. Turkey's always been a member of NATO, and Turkey's been trying to get into the EU, and the EU has been dragging its feet on Turkey for obvious reasons. So how would you see this playing out? Do you see an unraveling of the EU first, with other countries like I think Holland is going to be scheduling a vote on this? Is the EU going to start falling apart, and then perhaps after a Trump election, our country's going to be looking at NATO, and then you had also mentioned other institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. How do you see this possibly playing out?
It remains to be seen. But here is what I think the globalist establishment is afraid of in the United States and in Europe. When we look at what happened in England with this Brexit vote, it's obvious that at least in England, you had a bare majority, but a significant majority in that election that wanted to get out of the European Union, that has finally, apparently, had it with all of this migration, non-European migration to Britain and to elsewhere in Europe.
And that really seemed to be the driving issue, correct?
Yes. It seems to me, as of course one who has not been over there in years, just reading about this and listening, I was struck by the fact that that was really hitting their society as a debate, at the same time that the Trump candidacy is raising the fever pitch on this thing to a whole new level, even beyond what David Duke and subsequently Pat Buchanan were doing in the 1990s. We have finally reached a point where perhaps people that weren't tuned into Dr. Duke, that weren't tuned into Pat Buchanan becoming president of the United States 20 years ago, although I certainly voted for him, are now saying, you know, we've reached a point. Boy, look at all these people who are here. Look at all the crime. We're close to a $21 trillion debt and all the rest of it. And boy, we're just going down the wrong pathway. And so as Trump, when he does hit the mark and when he's pointing out some of the reasons that may well be the reasons why we have gone down the wrong pathway, more people, it seems, are listening. Now, with that in mind, whether it's Britain with this Brexit vote, whether it's the anti-New World Order, anti-globalist forces in the United States, or whether it's some of these same forces operating throughout Europe, when we get to the question of, say, something like NATO, this starts getting into the heart of the issue of NATO. Why did we join NATO? Well, we clearly joined this thing years ago in the post-World War II era. to keep Western Union, or Western Union, right, the Western Europe being overthrown by the Soviet Union, the old Soviet Union. Militarily, the United States was a part of that Atlantic alliance and still is. That was the sole statutory purpose of NATO. That was its own mission, was keeping Europe out of the hands of the communist Soviet Union, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, all well and good. But guess what? They don't exist anymore as the USSR. The Berlin Wall has fallen. Germany, for better or worse, is reunified. And now we have a completely different set of circumstances, not simply in terms of the fact that Russia is no longer a communist country, as we understood that under people like Stalin and Khrushchev. The old Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact are not threatening Western Europe militarily in any significant sense of the word. And then when we look at this whole issue of the ideology that used to undergird what we think of as anti-communism, and to a large extent I agree with that ideology when it's properly understood and tempered, nonetheless, here we are all this much time later, and at least a few of us who have always been identified as the right in the United States. Now, in my case, I am old right. I am not neoconservative right. But the old right certainly was an anti-communist right, and certainly that's where the old right was wavering on this whole issue of NATO. Ultimately, the U.S. did get into NATO. But the point is that now that the old Soviet Union is gone, we are not dealing with the quote-unquote communist threat in Europe. This has been accentuated, it seems to me, by what's almost, if not in fact, a role reversal between the United States and Western Europe on the one hand and Russia on the other as far as the culture. It seems that when you start talking about unquote godless communism, particularly in the cultural sense of that term, the United States now and Western Europe are espousing, militantly so, all of these post-Christian values and all these social issues and so forth. There is a general disdain in many respects, I argue, for a historic Christian influence on American culture that never used to be the case. On the other hand, Putin's Russia seems to be experiencing a renaissance in terms of Christianity, especially the Eastern Orthodox, Russian Orthodox Christianity. That was the ethos of Russia prior to the advent of the Bolshevik Revolution. There's an article today on Russia Insider. I guess this was published on Sunday, actually, my mother's birthday, June 26th.
Happy
I have
birthday.
Not had a chance to read it. It's 4,000 words long, so it's a little longer, but it's called Rejection of Christianity is at the Heart of Russia's Conflict with the West. Dr. Hauke Ritz, who is a German academic and Russia specialist, has written this article. And when I looked at that headline and I thought, you know, when I was a kid growing up during the Cold War, and my father was an Air Force colonel in the intelligence business, I had no idea what he did, but we saw ourselves as protecting the American way of life, which to us included some version of Christianity, in our minds anyway, from these godless communists. And it was in that regard that we supported the American military buildup against the Soviet Union. We supported NATO. We understood that if the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact had attacked Western Europe, that we would have gone to war, we would have supported the war, and we would have sent our best young people into that to defend those lands from the spread of quote-unquote godless communism. Well, I mean, how is that worldview reconciled with what's going on today?
Yeah.
The United States is a militantly post-Christian culture, as is Western Europe. We have the Frankfurt School, as we've talked about many times on Dr. Duke's show, to thank for that. And in that regard, we have a circumstance where the godless communism of the Bolshevik period in Russia for 70 years now seems to have been supplanted quite wonderfully by the older Eastern Orthodox, Russian Orthodox Christianity that is at the heart of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to me to be coming to the fore again. You see it in their media. You see it in Russia Insider. You see it in some of these other outlets. And in that regard, I'm thinking, if the rejection of Christianity is at the heart of Russia's conflict with the West, that had one set of meanings for most people in the late 1940s and 50s and early 1960s, but it means something completely different now. And it's in that regard that we look at this business of NATO, none of the ideological presuppositions past apply at all to NATO today, at least for me.
Mm-hmm.
And when you add to that the fact that the United States, as has been pointed out by many people, and we've talked about it on these other shows that we've worked together, the United States and NATO are systematically not only violating their original charter for NATO, but they have broken explicit promises made in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union to Mr. Gorbachev in particular, that the U.S. and NATO were not going to expand to the east. They weren't going to recruit Warsaw Pact powers to join. They weren't going to put NATO and American military forces, including rocket forces and airplanes, as well as troops, into those areas. And guess what? That's exactly what we're doing.
It is.
And when you add to that the illegal coup d'etat that the United States and the EU were directly involved in the Ukraine in February of 2014. This is nothing more than something that was undertaken chiefly for the bankers and chiefly for some of these Israeli-oriented oligarchs in the Ukraine. But the other aspect of the whole situation, clearly, is that there's now all this talk of trying to get Ukraine into NATO, renewed talk of getting Georgia NATO. Since when did anybody ever think that Montenegro ought to be in NATO?
And now this it is. Now it is.
Now it is, and that's ridiculous. And this simply has to be stopped before a totally needless war happens, where the United States and the Western powers are going to be chiefly at fault if it happens.
So NATO, which was formed. Was it 1948? I can't remember the exact year. It was in the late 40s, and it was formed as an alliance against the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union turned around and within a couple of years formed a counter alliance, the Warsaw Pact. But so NATO, it's post World War II. It coincides with the Cold War. And it may very well, it was explicitly to counter the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union in the late 40s was, it was communist, and there's this ideological dimension to it. I would submit that really the anti-communist aspect of it, the underpinnings of NATO, started unraveling not after the Cold War, but really pretty early in the Cold War. Because you think of the worst atrocities of the Soviet Union, when did they occur? It was in the first three decades. It was certainly during the years immediately after the so-called Russian Revolution, which was really a Jewish Bolshevik revolution. The years what they called war communism, I think there was a bit of a easing for a while during the new economic policy, but then in the late 20s, when they had the collectivization of agriculture, which set off this man-made and man-enforced famine in the Ukraine and some other areas, which we term the Holodomor, that's the late 20s, early 30s, and then certainly the years of World War II were very just extremely oppressive. And so these three decades, this is where you had the tens of millions of people dying, the tens of millions of victims.
Right.
Stalin died in 1952, And immediately there were massive changes. He was denounced by Khrushchev in a secret meeting of the Communist Party, but that secret didn't stay secret very long. Came out that he had been denounced, and the denunciation of Stalin wound up creating this rift between the Soviet Union and China, which from 1949 had been taken over by the Communist Party that took over almost all of China except for Taiwan. Mao being in many ways a protege of Stalin, somebody, I don't know how personal their connection was, but certainly he modeled his rule in a large way after Stalin, and especially in terms of the cult of personality. And so NATO being explicitly anti-Soviet wound up being a de facto ally of communist China, while communist China was undergoing its worst, its atrocities, its worst years. When you talk about the tens of millions of victims of Mao, you're talking about things that happened primarily between a period of about 1956 to 1976, the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. And that was a period where China was really a de facto ally of the United States and NATO. So what does that mean for NATO? Well, it was it was explicitly anti-Soviet. Really, more I think its anti-Soviet nature really trumped its anti-communist nature. Post-Stalin Soviet Union inherited a dysfunctional economic system and an oppressive political system. So it's not as if Soviet Union wasn't an oppressive dictatorship. But by the end of it, with Gorbachev's reforms, most of that had gone by the wayside. Then when the Soviet Union falls apart, you have Russia taken over really by these Jewish oligarchs, and the events you described, the expansion of, rather than having a dismantling of NATO because its stated purpose for existence no longer was there anymore, NATO wound up expanding in direct contradiction to its promises to Russia. And looking for a new mission. So NATO supposedly, under President Clinton, its focus was supposed to be on things like terrorism, and how well is NATO really functioning as an anti-terrorist alliance? We see it basically, members like the United States and Turkey, really supporting ISIS, supporting the terrorist organizations in the Middle East while Russia's fighting them. So the idea of it being an anti-terrorist alliance has become laughable. It's anti-Russian, and it's used as a tool of Zionist foreign policy. Because why should we even be anti-Russia if it wasn't for the fact that Zionist forces, not so much Israel specifically, but in the diaspora, really resent President Putin for having put an end to this Jewish oligarchic rule in Russia. So what's your take on that, Mark?
Well, I think you've absolutely nailed it. And so for those of us who are not pacifists, those of us like me old enough to remember the older, and I argue legitimate anti-communism. Those like me just old enough to remember the missile crisis, what I think may have been a turning point in the relationship between the old Soviet Union and the United States when Kennedy and Khrushchev finally cut a deal that averted catastrophe. We are now in a situation where none of the things that applied to NATO then arguably apply now. The old Soviet Union is gone. The old Soviet Union and the old Warsaw Pact are not only gone, but represent no threat to Western Europe whatsoever or to the United States. You have a situation, as you pointed out, Patrick, where it's not simply the fact that NATO had only one statutory purpose, and that statutory purpose was absolutely based on defense, absolutely based on deterrence. We now and only involve one theater of operation. Now we have a situation where NATO has become a global 9/11 force, it seems, to be utilized wherever the globalist Zionist entity wants it to be dispatched to. So whether you're talking about the hideous use of NATO in Libya, the implication that NATO is going to be introduced into Syria, if they can possibly figure out a way to do it, that is clearly outlandish. We have the suggestion that NATO, which is, as I understand it, conducting or shortly to be conducting military exercises in the Ukraine, mm-hmm. that is absolutely frightening, not simply in the dangers and risks, but the fact remains of those countries, one overthrown in the Ukraine, the other one Assad in Syria, would never have gone along with this. Assad doesn't go along with this. And here we have this strange reversal of fortune, where it seems to me that in terms of my understanding of the autonomy of people, my understanding of basic human rights, my understanding of national sovereignty, I support Assad in Syria. I'm not saying the guy's perfect. He's not my president, but he is the legitimate president of that country. And when it comes to supporting Assad, and the Christians overwhelmingly in that country support Assad, even though he is an Alawite Shia, that's where I'm coming from in this. And to the extent that Russia has intervened in this thing correctly and legally, which they have, and to the extent that Russia is putting it to Al-Qaeda and to Daesh, ISIS, that's entirely terrific as far as I'm concerned. Trump, at that juncture, needs to take it a step further and to concede what all of us know, and that is that it's not just a great thing that Vladimir Putin is doing this or doing some of this, but that the United States, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, and several of the Gulf Cooperation Council states are the reason for ISIS's creation, for its staffing, and for its logistical support, and its financial support, and its importation into Syria. So that when we look at this whole situation, when I think of the good guy and bad guy complex, or the Hopalong Cassidys and the Roy Rogers and the Lone Rangers of the world with their white hats, and I think of the bad guys wearing the black hats, there's a role reversal going on here, mm-hmm. and it is the United States and its so-called allies in the Ukraine and in the Middle East and in Europe who are wearing the black hats. We no longer need to see ourselves as being essentially on the side of good, because we're not. And when it comes to this whole business of God, if we are going to argue in any of these situations that it comes down to what would Jesus do, or who would God support in this situation if he had to choose, from my vantage point, the answer is clear. It'd be Vladimir Putin, on the basis of what seems to be his personal faith, as I read about it, what seems to be his facilitation and his encouragement of the reestablishment of Russian Eastern Orthodox Christianity in his country as their core ethos instead of communism. Vladimir Putin is intervening on behalf of my Christian brethren in Syria, uh-huh. even though I don't know any of these people. On the other hand, it is the globalists and the Zionists and those who support them, like Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, John McCain, Mitt Romney, Barney Frank, Joe Lieberman, Bill Kristol, Robert Kagan, Victoria Nuland, and all of these other people that are, as far as I'm concerned, not only clinically evil, but these are the people that are staffing and running my government, who are committing American kids and Western European kids to situations where we don't belong and where we are doing untold harm in the name of what you and I would say is clearly evil. Uh-huh. This has nothing to do with the old NATO Warsaw Pact, USSR model at all. Mm-hmm. And last but not least, when we add to that the so-called irony of an organization being called the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Is NATO chiefly being used today in the North Atlantic? What is it doing? Poking around in Ukraine. What is it doing in the southern underbelly of Europe? What is it doing in Libya? What is it doing exacerbating tensions in Syria and trying to stick its nose into that situation? What is it doing putting all kinds of military forces in the way of land, air, and sea that close to the borders of Russia in many of these former Eastern Bloc countries and territories? This is all dead wrong, and it's got to be stopped. Mm-hmm. And again, will the American people and the Europeans as a whole come to their senses on this before it's too late? You certainly hope so, because the alternative, it seems to me, is the very real specter, as Paul Craig Roberts has told us, as John Pilger has told us, as Robert Perry has told us, as Pat Cannon has told us, as Eric Margolis has told us, of a third world war. Mm-hmm. Under the auspices of the forces that want Hillary Clinton elected president of the United States. So yeah, this is where it is, and hopefully this Brexit vote is the beginning, beginning of a turning point where ultimately all of these globalist and pro-Zionist and Zionist organizations, including NATO, can be tossed out the car window.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll add at least one more name to that list of people warning against World War III, Professor Stephen Cohen.
That's right. You've mentioned him before. I'm now aware of who he is. Columbia University?
Princeton. New York University. And yes, I mentioned him just to show that this viewpoint is shared by people of very different backgrounds and perspectives, by serious people. Now, I thought it was interesting when you were talking about who would God support. So you're saying God would not support ISIS or Jewish oligarchs. that's kind of going out on a limb. But
at least the God I believe in, who in my particular case, getting into theology, will only take that pathway so far tonight for obvious reasons. But in terms of any form of historic Christianity, we understand that when you read the New Testament, I think we are on safe ground in saying that in terms of the way God and his Son are represented in the New Testament, support for any of these organizations is clearly contraindicated.
Yeah, I certainly go along with that. I was just bringing it out because I wanted to underscore it. Now, in the past, when we've talked, maybe it was a year ago or so when you were on the Dr. Duke show, you talked about a Libya-Syria connection, a Benghazi connection, information that was out there about Ambassador Christopher Stevens' activities or possible activities in terms of getting Gaddafi's captured weapons over to Syria to these anti-Assad forces, which wound up being ISIS forces. Would you like to recount some of that? Is that still fresh in your mind?
I think it's not fresh in my mind now, but you basically recounted the essence of the thing. As you start looking at some of the work that some of the better people have done to put some meat in the bones on that whole thing, and I believe Cy Hirsch is one of them. Mm-hmm. It is true to my satisfaction, at least, that consulting some of these other people, that this is exactly what was going on, which explains simply how Hillary Clinton has not been brought to heel on this as the so-called Secretary of State at the time that this criminality was going on. But you also have too many Republican Zionist neoconservative types that would have a vested interest in protecting at least that aspect of the larger context of Benghazi from ever appearing in investigation reports that come out of the House Intelligence Committee or otherwise, and certainly out of the news media. But I think in broad paintbrush stroke that is exactly what has happened. And then, of course, when you add to that some of the stuff that has happened on the Turkish-Syrian border. Going into October of 2014, not all that long ago, Serena Shim of Press Television in Iran, 29-year-old woman, mother of, I think, two young children. Mom, Judy Poe, is living in Michigan, I believe. But at any rate, Serena Shim was reporting on all these developments on the Syrian-Turkish border, which in her reports were giving me preliminary reasons to conclude that ISIS was controlling oil tankers that were being shipped from that part of Syria that it controlled, where there were oil fields, into Turkey.
Okay, so tankers, these would be like truck tankers.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that in essence, we would later learn that a Turkish oil company, where Erdogan's son, the Prime Minister Erdogan's son, was kind of the chief chieftain in the entire company, that they were the ones that were doing the business with all these tankers that continued coming across into Turkey from Syria and subsequently returning to Syria, returning to ISIS-controlled areas. Then when you add to that, of course, something that was mentioned on the Duke show today, and that is in Turkey, Erdogan's daughter, as I pointed out in a recent interview on this with Jonas Alexis over at Veterans Today, Erdogan's daughter in Turkey was involved in the same kind of medical hospitalization program at the highest level to patch these ISIS people up who were wounded, the ones who could return and fight, and get these people back across the border into Syria.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody can see that as an accident, and Israel's doing the same thing, of course.
Yeah, and one of the British newspapers, it might have been the Daily Mail, one of them sent a film crew and has video documentary evidence of the these Israelis, these people in, I guess from the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, treating and then releasing these fighters. And they say, well, we're so humanitarian, we don't care where they're from or which group they're from. We're just humanitarian and we're patching them up and sending them back because that's what we do. But just getting back to this Libya-Syria-ISIS connection, so when the United States overthrew Gaddafi and murdered Gaddafi through its proxies in Libya, you had this, Gaddafi had been in power for almost half a century, for about 45 years. He ran the most prosperous economy in Africa. And he had a stockpile of weapons, and these weapons then seem to have been raided by the occupying forces, and a good deal of them used to send to Syria for fighting. Now there's an interesting picture. I'm not sure if you had sent it to me or pointed it out to me or someone else had, of John McCain and I believe Sidney Blumenthal, the senator from Connecticut, a Jewish Zionist senator, with a Libyan man, somebody who had been involved in the overthrow of Gaddafi, and they're presenting him with some sort of award, some sort of medal. And as it turns out, that man is now running the ISIS operations in Libya, if we're to believe our sources.
What's his name? Al-Baghdadi? Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, I think, is the guy's name. Yeah, that's the guy. And these pictures are all over the internet showing John McCain. And I'm trying to remember now, was it Joe Lieberman? Was he the other, was he the United States Senator from Connecticut?
I think it's
independent.
No, Lieberman, he left the Senate, I think had left the Senate by then. So Blumenthal, I think his first name's Sidney. It might not be Sidney. But Blumenthal is, I'm not sure if he's his successor or somebody just who holds the other seat in Connecticut, but he's I believe he was the other person in the picture, another Connecticut Jewish senator, but not. I don't think it was Lieberman. McCain, of course, had become, pretty famously, had just become the Lieberman's little buddy, following yes. Lieberman all over the place, and I don't know. So that was that whole situation there. And I want to get back a little bit to NATO and Europe. And you had mentioned that Ukraine, that the people like John McCain are pushing for Ukrainian and Georgian membership in NATO. And John McCain's a very interesting person. He's got this connection with Mikhail Saakashvili, who used to be the president of Georgia, was the president of Georgia when Georgia initiated this really ill-conceived military action against Russia. Georgia was one of the Soviet republics, and it was a Soviet republic that had within it two what they called autonomous republics, two second-level republics that had very different ethnic groups in them. And at the time that Soviet Union broke up, these two autonomous regions of Georgia did not like did not like being with the rest of Georgia, and stuck out. It took a de facto independent situation, which had been ever since the breakup of the Soviet Union had been basically honored. That they were on the map, they were part of Georgia, but they were not ruled from Tbilisi. Their de facto independence had been basically guaranteed by the Russian Federation. In 2008, Georgia tried to enforce its rule on these two regions, and Putin sent them back to Georgia with their tails between their legs. That was Georgia. That was Mikhail Saakashvili, who subsequently was deposed as president of Georgia. He's for corruption, and he's went into exile, and then turned up in 2014 in Ukraine, and he is now the governor of one of the main Ukrainian provinces of Odessa.
Yeah, exactly.
And was almost appointed prime minister of Ukraine when the old prime minister resigned a couple of months ago. He was the one being pushed by John McCain. And so he's a major figure in Ukrainian politics now, which is kind of laughable. But just to finish my point, the idea of bringing in these countries that have grievances, that have grudges against Russia, and you already have countries that have grudges against Russia in NATO that have been brought in. I'm thinking of Poland and the three Baltic countries, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. To bring these into an organization that has as its, you know, its part of its constitution that an attack on one is an attack on everyone, this is just a really easy tripwire for World War III. One of these countries provokes some sort of action with Russia, as Saakashvili did while he was president of Georgia. You have some sort of military confrontation, and then suddenly the United States and these other major European countries are obliged to go to war against Russia.
Well, that's exactly right. The whole thing is outlandish, whether we're talking about Mikhail Saakashvili, we're talking about this person, an American citizen, who in 5 minutes after, virtually 5 minutes it seems, after arriving in the Ukraine, suddenly becomes their finance minister, and so forth and so on.
What's her name? I forgot her name. Valerie something. She was a State Department official.
Yeah, exactly.
I think had to leave the State Department for some sort of weird financial dealings.
Yeah, exactly. And so she's another one. Or then when you look not simply at Saakashvili, but some of these other people that have been appointed as provincial governors, it's the old central banking Jewish oligarch thing mm-hmm. all over again. But in principle, you're correct about the larger implications of this. And the best way that I can put it, and I think we've talked about this on Duke's show a little bit, and that is what I've proposed to my mother and a few other people. What would be the reaction of the average American if you had Soviet warships 5 miles off of our coasts what would our Russian warships, I'm sorry, what would the reaction be if we had Russian troops on our northern and southern borders? What would be the reaction if we were constantly experiencing flyovers from Russian military aircraft within our own territorial airspace and water space, and so forth and so on? You know what the reaction would be, and the American people would not simply put up with it. Be a demand for action to be taken, and we would be prepared, it seems to me, even at this late state in our history, in regard to the decadence and the indifference, if there was that type of a threat being posted right on our borders. I think there'd be a consensus in this country across the political spectrum. We've got to do something. We are not going to let them do this or push us around or threaten us and our families, so forth and so on. Now, why should it be any different when that's exactly what we're doing to Putin and Russia? Whether it's in the Ukraine, whether it's in this monkey business that we were fomenting with Shah Kashvili in this Georgian South Ossetian thing a few years ago in 2008, any of these things we're presently doing in Eastern Europe, especially in Poland and Romania in terms of the latest stuff, or these actions where we are engaging in these deployments, American naval deployments in areas of the Baltic that clearly would be perceived by anyone as being threatening. But this is going on, and it seems to me that with the way the American globalist Zionist media covers this stuff, those forces in our media are simply taking the attitude of, well, none of us believe in God, but God has nonetheless put us on his side, right? When it comes to this whole question of dealing with this evil dictator who threatens the peace and stability of the entire world. Really? Since when? And yet this is what we are being asked to believe in the entire NATO mission. I mean, I don't know how many of these guys from Breedlove on down we have to listen to in regard to the kinds of draconian statements that they are making about the Russian threat that have absolutely no bearing in reality whatsoever. And, you know, we're expected to believe this when, in fact, what you have going on here is all of these guys are trying to justify their budgets and their jobs and their reputations and their promotions. Now, okay, so there's a lot of that going on in Washington, D.C. at housing and urban development. That's one thing. But when you're talking about people doing this in our military and intelligence establishments that are going to get all of us killed, or that's going to bring the world to the brink of a third world war. Mm-hmm. And this isn't Mark Dankoff mm-hmm. or Patrick Slattery no. saying this at this point. These are all of these other people, including your Professor Stephen Cohen, that's saying right. this. And it's just the way, and it's obvious that they're right.
Yeah, you know, we talk about Putin as if he's some sort of dictator. He's extremely popular in Russia's approval ratings. As measured not by Russian polls, but by places like the Pew Foundation, which does a lot of international polling, his support ratings are something like 80%. And to the extent there's opposition to him, you know, there is the opposition that they talk about in the American press, but there's a growing dissatisfaction with Putin from people who feel that Russia's being pushed around and that he's not pushing back. There's I won't necessarily say it's opposition, but there's dissatisfaction that he is letting the West get away with too much. And there are calls for him to intervene militarily in Ukraine in a way that he hasn't. If we keep pushing and pushing and pushing on Putin, eventually these voices are going to be the ones that win out. And if Putin was to take some sort of action in Ukraine or you know, you've got these giant military exercises going on in Poland, and you mentioned military exercises that would be going on in Ukraine, but in Poland with the Operation Anaconda, which has been going on. If something were to happen, you know, it wouldn't be Putin's aggression. It would be a reaction to this constant pressure that he and Russia have been under for literally as long as the Soviet Union has been broken up. So it's a very dangerous situation, and it's the Russians are aware of it, and the Russian public is aware of it because it gets discussed on their shows. Americans are not aware of it. Americans have no idea how close we are to really a new world war, and it's, you know, it's not being covered in the American press. And one thing that Stephen Cohen said on his last week's broadcast with on the John Batchelor show, which I thought was fascinating, and I transcribed it and posted on davidduke.com. But he said that if the American media was doing its job and covering things that Donald Trump actually is saying, because he has talked about this, and he's the only one who's talking about it in the political arena, that if there were a fair hearing on this, American people don't want World War III. And that if there was a fair hearing and the press was doing its job and treating this as an issue, a campaign issue in the election, as it should be in a democracy, that Donald Trump would win the election. That all of this would not play out favorably for Hillary. People don't want to go to World War III, and if they knew what was going on, Donald Trump would win. And I thought that was an astounding statement coming from somebody who's, you know, married to the editor of the Progressive Nation magazine.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is where Trump simply has to take his case directly to the American people, and to do it clearly and to do it well, and to hit these points time and time and time again.
Yeah.
I think that really this issue of war and peace and who it is that we fight, who and what it is we fight for or should be fighting for, as opposed to what we often are fighting for, Trump has got to hit that hard, especially in an environment where we are now talking about drafting women as well as men and having a situation where the policies of Hillary Clinton are absolutely, if followed to their logical extension, are going to lead to national and international cataclysm. And as Paul Craig Roberts has so aptly put it, if you're for Hillary, you're voting for World War III. Quote-unquote.
Uh-huh. Well, in drafting women and, ironically, drafting transgender people. What would that do to poor Corporal Klinger in MASH, who is always trying to get out of war by dressing as a woman?
Well, you know what is interesting about all of that is, you know, that is that presents a very, very Jamie Farr, of course, played Klinger. I watched that show off and on for years. It's one of the many shows I used to watch on television. And to me, when you're looking at this whole thing at this juncture, when you look at American society, American values, American morals, American foreign policy, and all the rest of it, the United States military is a very different beast than it was when my dad was in it in his heyday in the Cold War, World War II, and then the Cold War. It's a very, very different entity today with different values, and is largely being asked to undertake its very dangerous missions on behalf not simply of an international agenda that you and I largely don't support at all and think is basically evil, but then when you look at the domestic character of the United States now, what is it we're trying to defend? And this is where I get back to the whole issue of the ideological wars. As I took my mother through this one night, on these people like George Soros and his support of all of these culturally Marxist things through his NGOs, clearly directed at destabilizing Vladimir Putin in Russia, among many other things around the world. Well, Putin, quite rightly, as I understand it anyway, has gotten rid of these Soros NGOs in his country. which is exactly the right thing to do. Well, the point is that my mother is a traditional conservative. She is a tradition American Christian of the older variety that invariably always tended to vote Republican, and she always has voted Republican. And she's looking with jaundiced eye now at some of these globalist Republicans that I've been trying to tell her are bums, that she now has concluded are bums of her own accord. But the point is, when we are looking at this whole situation, just as the media is consistently telling lies about Putin and about Russian military intentions and about this coup d'etat in the Ukraine and the truth about the so-called Russian annexation of Crimea, which, by the way, occurred only because of what we did in Ukraine, and it occurred because of a popular vote in Crimea, where it was just staggering, the overwhelming majority of people that wanted to go back to Russia if the alternative was this EU Zionist-backed government in Kiev in their lives. And we start looking at the lies the media is telling about Syria and Libya and all the rest of it. We then look at the lies that are being told about the internal social conditions in Russia, the laws of Russia as it pertains to certain social subjects that have been totally misrepresented in the American press, up to and including Bob Costas of NBC News and the outlandish coverage that he engaged during the Sochi Olympics in promoting the LGBT agenda, as Costas understands that. And of course, he is a Jew, which is, to me, not insignificant.
Is he?
That's what I understand. Okay. Dr. Duke indicates so.
I thought he was Greek, but he is certainly part of this whole Jewish media mindset. Okay. Well, we're coming up on the end of the hour, and I just want to bring this back to the Brexit vote. So this program has been largely about the implications for NATO and what NATO's doing. It would be nice if Donald Trump, who may be elected, he's been talking about re-examining NATO. If NATO would come under examination, and maybe you had some exit talk from NATO. I wonder who it would start with. Maybe it would start with Donald Trump, and there would be no NATO without America. So do you have any final thoughts?
Yes. Again, we're right back to what I say in my new article, which is out there at Mark Dankoff's America. The contents of that article, by the way, or that interview with Jonas E. Alexis, are part of his interview with both Michael Hoffman and me at Veterans Day on this whole issue of Brexit. Between what I said at great length in this reasonable length in this article and what I said for press television in 3 minutes, the Brexit vote in the UK is either the beginning of a turning point in this whole battlefield, not between communism and anti-communism as we understood that in a bygone era, but it is a battle between globalism and Zionism on the one hand, which are inextricably linked, and nationalism. This is where it is. And if you are a nationalist, if you're an American nationalist, a German or Austrian nationalist, if you are a British nationalist, if you are a nationalist in any of these Middle Eastern countries, we all understand that this globalist thing is a lot of poppycock. It is destroying our families, our communities, our nations, and our lives. And we'd like to see it put in the ash heap of history.
Well, thank you very much, Reverend Mark Dankoff, for coming on the National Bugle Radio, and I hope you'll be coming back again soon. You've got so much... you're an amazing researcher, and you've got such a good grasp on so many issues and areas. And good luck with all of your other media work that you do, and thank you for coming on.
Patrick, God bless you, and I'll be looking forward to you perhaps talking with me next week if we're together again with David Duke, or if we're doing another show for you on this network.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.